quite a lot of stuff. We basically looked at differential geometry from probably a slightly more formal point of view than when it was originally introduced, and talked about what, you know, how you define vectors, the tangent space at a point, tangent bundles, covectors, and started discussing the concept of differentiation. So we looked at forms and exterior derivatives, and also derived an expression for the Lie derivative. So I want to move on from there, saying a little bit about geometrical significance of the Lie derivative, and then also the form of differentiation that you're familiar with, which is the covariant derivative and curvature. So the Lie derivative, we said that the Lie derivative of V along the vector field U, we did it via components, and we said that was you took the derivative along U and subtracted off the derivative of U along V and found that that was tensorial, well, in this case, a vector. So that was what we derived yesterday. But this is also denoted as a bracket, which is indeed a commutator or Lie bracket of two vectors, where since the Lie derivative of V with respect to U is a vector, that tells you that this commutator is also in the tangent space, and you define it, since it's a vector, it's defined by its action on functions. So that's another way of writing it. I chose to derive it in its coordinate form in order to make explicit why this was a reasonable thing to do for differentiation. So I was literally taking the sort of standard basic calculus formula of a derivative and trying to generalize it to vectors. But this is an alternative way of writing the Lie bracket, and it's a way which makes its algebraic structure more transparent, because you see it's an operation on TP of M cross TP of M and maps it into TP of M. So I'd like to talk a bit about geometrical significance of the Lie bracket. And so if you look at this expression here, what that's sort of suggesting is that you go a little bit along U, a little bit along V, then a little bit along U, and subtract, doing the process the other way around, a little bit along U and a little bit along V. So we know, although of course this needn't vanish even on a flat space, the idea of curvature is sort of with giving you this concept that things that are not necessarily commutative, doing something the one way round if you're wandering out into your manifold, is not the same way as doing it the other way round. So if I think about going a little bit along, I think I've got them mixed up now. So if I start at a point O, then I can go a little bit along U and a little bit along V, and I get to the point B. Or I could go the other way around, V and then U. And what I'm going to say is that this thing here is related to the commutator. So let's just look in general at what it means to go a little bit along a curve. So if we look at the coordinates of the point at A, so I'm just going to write a little subscript of O, A, B, C, or D to tell you where we are and where we're evaluating something, then this is going to be the base point O coordinates. We've wandered a little bit T along U, and we're going to need to do things to order our infinitesimal parameters squared, so I have to add a half t squared times the derivative of u along u. So this is just doing a Taylor expansion of our coordinates to find the coordinates of the point at A to second order in t. And so I'm simply going to use this general expression with A replaced by B, C, and D, and 0 replaced by either A or C as appropriate, to find the coordinates of the point B and the coordinates of the point D.
Sorry,
shall I write it underneath, make it a bit clearer? So, what we do is we look at point B. So again, applying this general relation, that would be the same as the point A. Oops, plus S. So I use that expression with with B replacing A and A replacing 0, and of course we're moving a little bit S along V. And then I'm just going to replace the A's with the zeros and keep things simply to order S squared or T squared or ST. So X we just wrote down so I can just write that out again. Then I need to know what V is at A, but V at A is just V at 0. Plus a linear term. I'm not interested in the quadratic term at this point because that would be of order cubed. And then finally, because I'm now already at order S squared, I can simply replace the A with a zero. So that's my expression to order S squared or ST. Now, if I want to get the expression for D, it's going to be the same, but I swap S and T and U and V. So all I've done there is I've literally just written everything out and swapped my U's and V's and S's and T's and hopefully haven't messed anything up in the process. So therefore the amount by which this little loop does not close is simply xb minus xd to this order. Technically, we know they're in different tangent spaces, but they are close enough that at this order, we can simply superpose. So you can see the x zeros cancel. This sv0 kills that one there. This half s squared there kills that one there. The tu0 kills that there. And I've managed to forget there. That t squared, the derivative u along u, kills that one there. And so the only pieces that I'm left with are the cross terms st and so I'm left with the Lie bracket. So we're normally used to thinking of coordinate systems where we draw a grid. It's possibly a deformed grid, but where every point on the grid has a unique label. That's our definition of a coordinate system. But I also talked about alternative bases for the tangent space. And it's possible, if you change basis to something which isn't just the coordinate system, that if you integrate along the curves of your basis vectors, they may not close. So that's sort of telling you something about the structure of the vectors and the vector fields that you've chosen. So a particularly important application from the perspective of gravity of the Lie derivative, something which is known as a Killing vector. So there are very often vector fields along which the Lie derivative of the metric vanishes. And they're important because they correspond to symmetries. And symmetries are very important in finding general fully nonlinear solutions for gravity. So you've probably seen that already applied to cosmology. The other thing I wanted to mention about the Lie derivative, and I want to leave it up, so that's why I'm putting it over here, is that there is a relation between the two derivatives that we've talked about, the non-covariant ones, d and the Lie derivative. So I invite you to prove that by simply looking at what it actually means. So remember, this is essentially the map omega from V to the real. So this is a number, and it's being acted on by the vector u. and then you swap the order of U and V, and then the Lie bracket is the piece that tells you that that's the same as taking d omega. Yeah, so this is normally, we've just so far just written a single covector and a single vector. But this general notation, this is a two form, or in particular, a second rank covariant object. And here I've put two vectors. So there's an ordering here of these two vectors. So if you were writing it in indices, this U would go with the first index on d omega, if you like. So it's simply giving an ordering of the way this mapping. Because this is a two form, it's a mapping from the vector space across the vector space into the reals. But of course it's ordered. So those are the types of derivative you may not have met, but of course the one you have met is the covariant derivative. So I'm really going to be focusing in on the metric connection because of course that's the one relevant for gravity, but I will, as I'm sort of going through this story, I'll also point out where you can get slight deviations if you were to choose not the metric connection. So as I've said on a couple of occasions, a connection is literally does what it says. It connects the tangent spaces at different points. Without the connection, your tangent bundle is just sets of different tangent spaces. This thing is like a glue. It glues them together, and then it glues them in a particular way, which can potentially be non-trivial, and usually is, and the curvature tells you about that non-triviality of the gluing. So you define your connection, well, usually you see it as this. So if you want to find the connection components, you kind of look at how they act on your basis. So this grad, the connection or the covariant derivative, it's a derivation, so in other words, it's sort of a derivative operator on the geometrical operator in its own right. It reduces to D on functions. That's sort of, essentially, it's telling you what it does on the simplest thing of all. It's also Leibnizian, which is your standard requirement for any sort of derivative type of operator. And it commutes with contractions, i.e. these objects here, omega v. So grad of omega v of this whole thing would be grad omega contracted with V plus omega grad V. So that's just it's a bit abstract, it's a bit sort of general, but those are the properties that a connection has to satisfy. So if we look at what that means, say, if we look at what grad V is, then this is so it's grad of the geometric object V. The geometric object V is a set of components, scalars, VA, contracted with the basis vectors, EA. This commutes with contractions, so we'll just take grad of VA. So that's Leibnizian. Then grad reduces to D on functions. And then I've just replaced what grad of my basis vector is. But this object here is just VA comma B omega B. And so if I relabel, swap my A's and C's, then you see that I get the standard expression for covariant derivative that everybody is very familiar with. So this is the usual expression. So this is an example I was asked yesterday about, you know, what I meant when I was writing T mu, for example. And I discussed and said that some of the time, or most of the time, actually, once we get off this preliminary bit, T mu would simply stand for the vector itself. But this is an example where you sort of see this interplay between this geometric way of writing things and where these VAs are actual functions. So while you're doing all these operations, you're treating VA as a function. But you see that what you end up with is grad V is exactly this expression for the derivative in components that you're familiar with. So it's sort of saying that, you know, everything's okay, really. So, of course, in GR, we...
So, grad VA is equal to dVA, just by definition.
Because the VAs are functions. They are the components. Here, this is the vector. That's the geometric object. These are the components. Therefore, by the property of, you know, one of the requirements on the covariant derivative, that must just reduce to d, which is, of course, just simple partial differentiation for the function. So I think what with the point about that abstract index notation, or the point Penrose was trying to make, is that we sometimes play a bit fast and loose when we're doing calculations, but it is okay. There's not a problem, and I think he was just trying to formalize it. But I think it's worth just sort of pointing that out. So GR uses the metric connection. Which tells you that grad of G equals zero, so I suppose I should underline things to emphasize they're the geometric objects. So this is where this notion, or this phrase parallel transport arose. Because, of course, the metric is what is not, doesn't just measure distances. The metric tells you about angles as well. Because the metric is, it's not an inner product, because, of course, in GR it's not positive definite. But it's telling you, if you take u dot v, it's telling you about the angle between u and v. And so if if your metric is covariantly constant and you move, you sort of take the, you move u along v such that grad v of u doesn't change, then you'll see the angles don't change. So that's really where this phrase parallel transport began. But of course, you can make all sorts of connections which are not metric, and you still use the phrase parallel transport.
Mm-hmm. What does that omega b cross ec actually mean?
That's simply just, it's just a tensor. It's saying, I mean, I needn't put it there, but it's really just saying it's a tensor product of the one form and the vector.
Okay, but for a simple case, if it's just a one component, if it's just a one form times a vector, what
would it be? You really need to put it there. No, but I just put it there by, it's not, it's
not important. It's going to be a matrix, isn't it?
What?
That omega v cross ec.
Well, it's a mixed tensor. So it is a tensor, but it's sort of a mixed covariant contravariant. It's not really a matrix, it's a geometric object, because omega really is a one form.
And that thing forms a basis for all these things.
Yeah, it forms a basis for that space. I suppose sometimes I put in the tensor products and sometimes I don't. This is actually not enough to specify the GR metric, the GR connection. Because it's also something we call torsion free. So the torsion tensor is something which is telling you about reversing the order of differentiation. So this will be zero for all u and v, for the general relativity connection. You hear this sort of phrase saying that the connection is symmetric, and that's what torsion free means. Well, it almost means that, not quite. If you put in and look at what here, if you look at what this translates to in component form, then your first two, grad uv minus grad vu, if you put in basis vectors there, you're obviously going to pick up connection components. But because of the presence of this Lie bracket at the end, you've got an additional piece. So usually, if you're in the coordinate basis, this vanishes, and so you would have a symmetric connection. But more generally, we want to think what happens for a general basis, general frame for your vector, your tangent spaces. Then that commutator need not vanish. And these things are called the structure constants. The basis. So these two requirements, torsion-free metric connection, give you the familiar Levi-Civita symbols for the connection components, gamma. GR course. Okay, so that's again familiar stuff, maybe done slightly differently. But what I want to do now is to continue with this sort of language, slightly more formal language, and think about this connection and how I can relate the connection and the basis to find an expression or perhaps an easy way of computing those Levi-Civita symbols. Because they're often reasonably manageable in four dimensions because there's not too many to compute. But obviously as you go to, if you sort of start having more and more dimensions, computing the connection, if you go from that expression, can be quite an involved job and sometimes make mistakes. So what I want to do is to introduce something called the Cartan structural equations, which are a different way of computing connections and curvature. Also, this formalism is used if you're doing, again, spinners in space-time. So if you want to look at solutions to the Dirac equation, then you'll also be using this type of formalism. So what you do is you take your connection, gamma, you mop up remember this first index is the one that corresponds to the taking the derivative. So when you take the covariant derivative, this would be the index that corresponded to the grad. And then you multiply by one of the basis one forms. So this thing is now a one form, but it's one of these sort of mixed objects. It's a one form, but it has components, so it's like the matrix. This is a matrix, but it's a matrix of forms. So so we have a relation between the components of the connection one forms and the components of the metric. So let me just actually demonstrate that. This is fairly quick to do. So if I look at D of G, make sure I get there. Then GAC are a set of functions. They're the components of the metric in a particular basis. So I can replace D with grad. So that's, again, using that property of the covariant derivative. And then I can write out what I actually mean by GAC. So the components are simply taking the actual tensor G and contracting with the basis vectors to pick out the components along those basis elements. Now, my metric connection is covariant, covariantly constant, so grad g vanishes. And I simply pull the covariant derivative inside the expression, because it commutes with contractions, and act it first on EA and then on EC. But then I can replace grad EA by that expression for using the connection components. So remember, grad EA was gamma A, C, B, omega C, E, B. But of course, this is just my connection one form. And then the same thing for the second expression. But of course here, this is just GBC. And that second expression is just GAB. And so what I get is just that symmetrized theta symmetrized connection one form. So therefore what that tells me is that if I have an orthonormal basis, by which I mean that GAB equals eta AB. So that's exactly what you usually mean by an orthonormal basis. If the two vectors are the same, you get a dot product of 1. If they are different, you get 0. Then D of eta AB is just 0. And so what that tells you is that the symmetric part of the connection one forms vanish. Okay. So that expression tells me how to compute the symmetric part of the matrix, of the connection one-form matrix. And then, if I could compute the anti-symmetric part of it, or had another way of finding the other components, then that would enable me to actually get these connection one-forms. So, let's look at this the wedge product of the one forms with basis element. So if I simply replace what that is, with the connection symbols, the gammas, then because this it's a two-form, it's anti-symmetric under swapping the omega B and omega C. What it's telling me is what I'm really doing is taking the anti-symmetric part of the connection there. But we know that's a sort of telling us something about torsion. So I just simply use that expression for the components of the torsion. Now, the first part, I can define a torsion 2 form. So this is in general the components of an N form. So an N, if you have a P form, you would generally write it as the components cross some basis vector with a combinatorial factor out front. So that's what that's defines for me my torsion 2 form. And then what's left is this, these structure constants. So I'm just writing down what they actually are in terms of the elements of the commutator of the basis vectors.
And
yes.
It doesn't have any indices.
No, it's TA, you're right. Thank you, Callum. Because T itself had three indices, yep. Keeping me honest, the index police. But now I'd like to use the expression that I've got over there for the relation between D and L, because if I put in basis vectors for my omega U and V over there, you see that because these are now basis vectors, this contraction of omega A with EB just gives me delta AB, which is either 1 or 0. It's a set of constants, so if I act on that by a vector, I just get 0. So, in other words, I can replace this here I think that works. So all I've done is use this relationship between D and the Lie derivative and the fact that these are just constants, contraction of the basis of one, dual basis, omega A, to the vector basis, EA. But now, all I've done here is D of omega A is a 2 form. This is simply taking the BC components of that 2 form and so by definite, and then I'm now multiplying by omega B cross omega C again, so by definition this is just T minus D omega. And so this tells me what is called, gives me what's called Cartan's first structural equation. And it gives me a quick way of computing the connection, because for a metric torsion-free connection, obviously that right-hand side is zero. If I choose an orthonormal basis, I know these are anti-symmetric, and therefore all I do is I take my basis of one forms, which are there only four of them if I'm in four dimensions, I take D, I look at what D of omega A is, and peel off the expression in terms of the basis, omega C, and then I've got my theta ACs. From my theta ACs, I can deduce the gammas, if I want to. So just to finish off, we'll see how these relate to curvature. So, again, I'm not entirely sure how curvature was introduced to you, but one of the ways you can think about curvature is by drawing an analogy with field theory. So in field theory, we have we usually have some sort of gauge symmetry, which is what I was talking about yesterday, where we make a gauge covariant derivative and we add a piece with a gauge field to compensate gauge transformations on phi. So let's just compare that to grad A, or rather grad of V. This is this abstract index notation again. So it's essentially very, very similar, where our connection now here is taking the role of the gauge field in this particular case. And if we want to think about curvature, this is a gauge potential, we simply take a commutator of these gauge covariant derivatives. So that's how we construct our derivative. And so in general, our gauge covariant derivative is going to be d mu a mu minus d mu a mu minus the commutator of the A's acting on phi. So obviously when you do electromagnetism, there isn't a commutator because A is just like, you know, a number, or that's a vector, but it's each component is a number. But of course, if you've got a non-abelian gauge group, then the A's do in general have a non-zero commutator. So that would be the group commutator for the gauge field. And so exactly analogously, you define your curvature in terms of a commutator of derivatives, covariant derivatives. So you say I take, R is my Riemann curvature, as it's defined canonically, if you put it in indices as one up and three down. So in other words, it's a mapping from TP of M cross TP of M cross TP of M into TP of M. And you define it simply by saying this is effectively the Riemann identity, which is saying that if I have sort of grad A, grad B minus, or you would normally write grad mu minus grad mu of V lambda would be R lambda mu nu sigma B sigma. So that's what that is encoding there. So in components, so you take basis vectors here. I knew I'd forget the ordering there. Has to be the C and D on the connect structure constants for the symmetry. So you may not have seen that expression in that form the first time you met it, because you wouldn't have been considering bases that might have had structure constants. So this is just saying if you've got an absolutely general basis, it's the normal expression in terms of the connection, but there's like a bookkeeping term which you have to add in, which is essentially just taking care of the fact that your basis might have these non-zero Lie brackets. So remember that diagram about the geometrical significance of the Lie bracket, about the curve that didn't close. That's normally, you think of curvature as being telling you something about parallel transport round a closed curve. And sorry. The what, sorry?
The grads.
Yeah. Point.
Thank you.
Brackets mixed up there.
So curvature tells you about parallel transport around a closed loop. And it tells you that if you parallel transport around a closed loop, you come back not to quite the same vector. And the amount by which it's not the same is proportional to the area of the loop and the curvature inside the loop. But obviously you've got to get around the closed loop to do that. And that's where that new V comes from. Okay? That's closing the loop for you. So that's why that extra term is in there. So there's also a second structural equation. You take the Riemann tensor and mop up the last two indices on it, make it into a two form. Then Cartan's second structural equation is given by taking the derivatives of the connection one forms. Now, written in that format, you see directly the analogy with gauge theories and the gauge covariant derivative and the curvature the field strength. Because remember that F mu nu was like dA plus the commutator of two A's. Here you've got d theta plus theta wedge theta, an anti-symmetric product. So this sort of brings out this analogy extremely well. So it's a bit of a long and tedious proof, which I'm not going to go through in lectures, but again, you do the same sort of thing that we did for the first structural equations, looking at the definition of R for basis vectors and manipulating the expressions that you have, and again, using this relation between D and L. So just to finish off, I'll just say again what you probably did already, but to emphasize that although I've been talking about all this from a mathematical perspective, curvature is really the physics of the gravitational field. It tells us about tidal forces. So you look at what do you mean by a tidal force? Well, a tidal force is telling you about how things close by move. They are together or apart, and that's what a gravitational wave does. And so you have, if you have a sort of set of geodesics, so we'll take them labeled by T. And then I'm going to define an S coordinate. I'm going to start here, and this is at sort of T equals constant. And I'm just going to label each of these geodesics by S, so that obviously my commutator is going to vanish, because going a little bit here, S and then T is the same as going T and then S. And so we're just going to label label our geodesics by, which we can always do locally. We might not be able to do it all the way along the curves because things could go wrong, but in a neighborhood of some point, we can certainly do this. So if we put in S and T to our definition of the Riemann tensor, and then acted on the tangent vector T to the geodesics, so that was just rewriting out our expression for the curvature, then I know that this last covariant derivative vanishes because I've made the Lie bracket of S and T zero by construction. I also know that this term vanishes because of the geodesic equation, grad T of T is zero. So what I'm left with is minus grad T, grad S of T, but because the Lie bracket vanishes, I can say grad S of T is grad T of S. And so what this is telling me is essentially something about the rate of change, the sort of acceleration of distances, because S is measuring, that vector S is measuring the distances away from these geodesics, the perpendicular distances, if you like. So if this was a time-like geodesic, you would simply take, these would be zeros in the Riemann tensor, and you would be saying, well, the, you know, S double dot plus some matrix times S is zero, and that would reduce actually to the sort of Newtonian expression, roughly anyway, certainly in style. You know, if d by dt was like r coordinate time. So it's telling you about how geodesics accelerate together or apart. So that's the sort of physics of curvature. So what I want to do tomorrow is to look at the concepts that we've brought up today in a practical example. So you've met black holes already, but I want to show you how, for example, the Killing vectors, the Lie derivative of the metric vanishing, simplifies metrics for you, and also apply those Cartan equations to computing curvatures for a spherically symmetric system. So that will actually, from first principles, will derive the Schwarzschild solution. And the usefulness of having done it that way is if you go up to more dimensions, the differences are essentially very minor. It's just tweaking something here and there, and you get very similar expressions in higher dimensions. And it's much easier to see that when you're approaching things from a slightly more geometrical point of view, rather than sort of slogging your way through computing loads and loads of connections and their derivatives. Okay, thank you. Any general questions?
So I had a quickly point about those thetas. You said that they were, in a certain case, they're anti-symmetric. Mm-hmm. So theta A up, theta down. Mm-hmm. So what do you mean by that exactly?
Well, what I wrote was that when you brought the index downstairs, that they were then anti-symmetric. So to raise and lower indices, you are using the components of the metric with respect to the basis. If you've chosen an orthonormal basis, your metric is just now eta ab, so it's either plus or minus 1 or 0, every component. So what you do is your actual object, the theta, has one index up and one index down. You lower that index with respect to the metric in your basis. In the examples we'll be doing, it's an orthonormal basis. And then once the index is lowered, that what's left is now a symmetric or anti-symmetric matrix. It's not a tensor because those indices are labeling scalar functions.
You weren't talking about the symmetry of something with one up and one down?
No, I was just writing it because once you've got a metric, you can raise and lower indices at will. However, the geometrical object is usually defined in index terms, the indices in specific positions. You always write the Riemann tensor with the first index up and the next three down, okay? And that is because it's defined in terms of this set of commutators of derivatives. And so these are vectors, so they're mopping up co-vector indices. These three have a natural order. And so you never, you're always very specific about which slot you're in with your tensors. And so the same thing with the connection one forms, that the geometric object, the way it's defined, it has one index up and one index down. But as you say, if you want to talk about the symmetries, you want to bring that first index down or lift the second one up so that you can actually then talk about swapping the indices. So it is not that the mixed matrix is anti-symmetric. Yep.
Okay, another thing is already, but by construction, the bracket of SMT is zero, doesn't say that obviously.
Because the Lie bracket tells you about things not closing. So when I drew my U and V, I had U like this, I had U, V, V, U. And so this was the commutator of U and V. In this case, this is my S, and that is my vector T. I'm going a little bit S along one, the normal, or a normal vector, a little bit T along the geodesic, or I go a little bit T along the geodesic, and then along this connecting vector. So it is... because that closes, by construction, I've chosen my coordinate so that that closes. I therefore know that that commutator vanishes. So I can only do this in a local neighborhood, right? Because geodesics will sort of deform. They may even have a caustic where they all cross. But as long as I'm, you know, as long as I'm careful and I only ever say I'm in a small neighborhood, I can always choose those coordinates. It doesn't mean that they extend to something sensible for, you know, for a large way out. It's just something I can do locally.
Mm-hmm. I'm kind of confused about your notation. When you say... when you say covariant derivativity of T, what does that mean?
Okay, that means if... so that is standing for, another way might be T dot grad of T. In components, it's, you would say grad T of T A would be, so you've got T... you take the partial derivative along T. That's what it means. It's in components, you would have your components of grad V TA, and then you mop up the differentiation index. So it is, this is, it is in that sense a differential along the geodesic labeled by the parameter T. So that's like the covariant derivative of S along T. I think you need a break.